Welcome to the History Maps podcast. If you really want to understand the military and political landscape of East Asia between the 13th and 16th centuries, you have to talk about the Wokie.
You absolutely do.
Their name, it translates to Japanese pirates. And for centuries, these raids along the coasts of Korea and China, they weren't just a nuisance.
No, not at all. They were like a force of nature. They shaped military policy. They forced governments to restructure. And I think most surprisingly, they ended up providing the ultimate justification for a full-blown dynastic revolution.
It's incredible.
It is. And the traditional picture of the Wokou is, you know, deceptively simple, just bandits from Japan. But once we start this deep dive into the sources, and we're talking everything from military biographies of Korean generals to modern GIS analysis of Min coastal defenses, you see this extreme complexity emerge.
So what's our mission today?
Today, we're going to focus specifically on the early Wokou era. This is a period really rooted in the instability of the late 14th century. We're going to look at the existential crisis they caused in Goryeo, Korea.
And the rise of a certain General Yixian Gai.
Exactly, who becomes a Taiho of Doxian. And then we'll shift to China and see how the brand new Ming dynasty tried to respond with, well, with architecture and policy to survive this coastal threat.
What's so striking to me is how this regional instability, mixed with all this economic pressure, created this this extra national force. It just fundamentally reshaped the geopolitics of the entire region.
Right.
This isn't just a story about, you know, little maritime skirmishes. It's about how states are formed, about technological gaps, and about an empire just failing to grasp basic economics.
And we're using everything. We have legendary accounts, we have detailed geospatial data, all to understand how these governments reacted to a threat that just refused to fit into a simple national box.
Absolutely. So to really get a handle on this, you're saying we have to make a distinction first.
A crucial one. Historians break it down into two main phases. First, you have the early Wokou, who peaked around the late 14th century. These were largely impoverished people, mostly based on the Japanese islands. But even then, their ranks were way more mixed than the name suggests.
And the second wave?
The second wave, the later Wokou of the 16th century, that's a whole different ballgame. They were predominantly wealthy ethnic Chinese smugglers, coastal merchants, who were basically exploiting the Ming dynasty's incredibly damaging maritime ban, the Heijin policy.
So two very different groups under the same name.
Exactly. The first phase was critical for Korea's collapse and rebirth. The second phase, that was catastrophic for the internal stability and the economy of Ming China.
Okay, let's start there then. Let's unpack this term and the identity behind it. If the Wokou were such a profound force, who exactly were they? And that name, it's a pretty loaded term, isn't it?
It is deeply loaded. The term itself, Wokou, is ancient. Literally, it means dwarf bandits.
Dwarf bandits, wow.
Yeah. And its first recorded use goes all the way back to the Gwanggaeto Stele. We're talking 414 CE. In Goguryeo territory. So this idea of raiders coming from the Japanese islands has a very, very long history in Korea.
But the crisis we're talking about, the one that reshaped dynasties, that surged much later.
Dramatically later, in the 14th century, the constant devastating coastal raids, that really became a state-level crisis then.
And that timing in the 14th century seems directly connected to political chaos inside Japan, right? This wasn't just random crime.
Precisely. The rise of this large-scale piracy was, you know, directly fueled by political and economic collapse within Japan.
What was happening there?
Well, you had decades of intense internal warfare, especially after the Mongol invasions of Japan failed. Those invasions, they destabilized everything. They sped up the decline and the eventual fall of the centralized Kamakura Shogunate in 1333 CE.
Which leads to even more conflict.
Exactly. The Nambokucho period, this long era of fighting between rival imperial courts that just completely fractured any sense of national authority.
So when that central government control disappears, what happens to the average person living on the coast?
It's disastrous. You have economic depression, local famines, widespread hardship, especially for people on the outlying islands. Organized government just dissolves, and suddenly piracy becomes a viable and, for many, a necessary way to survive.
So these early Wokou, the ones attacking Korea, they're not an organized army.
Not at all. They're largely marginalized groups. Impoverished peasants, maybe some displaced warriors, runin, and fishermen, who were basically forced into it because there was no food and no resources at home. And their main bases, according to all the records, were concentrated around the outlying islands of Kyushu.
Which are?
The big three were Tsushima, Iki, and Gochu. I mean, if you look at a map, they are perfectly positioned for raids on the Korean peninsula.
And this is so crucial. Despite the name Woku, meaning Japanese pirates, the reality was much more complicated. This was a multinational enterprise, wasn't it?
That is a critical point for this deep dive. The sources are very clear that Woku members were drawn from Japan, from Korea, and from China. They were this opportunistic kind of floating community of people driven by pure economic desperation and, you know, the promise of plunder.
So how did the Korean court deal with that? They must have known it wasn't just one single enemy.
What's truly fascinating is the nuanced view they took. The Korean court understood that the people they called Wajin, that is, people of Wa or Japan, were not a single unified national enemy. They were sophisticated about it.
That seems incredibly difficult to maintain while your coastline is literally on fire.
Mm-hmm.
How did they manage to parse that complex identity?
Well, the Korean ruling class, especially in the Joseon Dynasty that came after, they saw Nippon Japan proper as something distinct from the Wajin, particularly the ones operating nearby. We have records from the 15th and 16th centuries where they explicitly distinguish between people from Japan, you know, the mainland shogunate, and those from the nearby three islands.
The three islands being Tsushima, Iki,
and Hakata, yeah. For instance, you have King Seijo ruling in 1459, and he comments on this very thing. He notes that Japan itself was so far away that official travel was rare. He specifically identified the pirate threat with the people of these three islands.
So he's framing it as a local problem, not a national war.
Exactly. A localized regional issue driven by island poverty and a lack of central control, not a concerted war effort from the Japanese mainland.
So if a Korean record identifies someone as a Wajin, it doesn't automatically mean they're a subject of the shogun in the way we think about national identity today.
Absolutely not. It's more of a geographical or maybe a linguistic or cultural affiliation, but not a rigid national loyalty. And the Korean court often tried to categorize and even integrate these people. We have these fascinating case studies that prove it.
Like what?
Well, consider a man named Shimon Kuru in 1441 CE. He was a Wajin with a Japanese name, came from Tsushima, but he formally asked to stay in Korea and become a Korean subject.
And what was his justification?
He explicitly stated that both his mother and his father were Korean, and King Sejong, who was ruling at the time, actually granted his request. He acknowledged this dual identity and allowed him to assimilate.
That suggests a very deliberate policy of separating the person from the label of pirate.
It does. And another great example is Jurotoro in 1510. He was a Wajin living with his wife in a Korean settlement for Wajin called Jeppo. And when he was brought before the authorities, the governor explicitly judged him not to be a Japanese Wajin.
Meaning what? Exactly.
Meaning he wasn't from inner Japan. He was a resident Wajin, someone whose identity was already intertwined with the Korean coastal structure. These people had complex non-national allegiances, so that blanket term, Japanese pirate, it's just historically misleading for a huge number of people involved in this early phase.
It reveals this fluid kind of extra-national maritime culture that defied easy categorization.
Right, and that made them incredibly difficult to govern or negotiate with, especially for the struggling Goryeo dynasty in Korea.
Okay, let's shift our focus there now. The catastrophic effect these raids had on the peninsula. It really exposed the failure of Goryeo's central government.
For Goryeo, the Woku raids were, without exaggeration, the worst military crisis after the decline of Yuan Mongol rule in the region. The sheer scale of the problem was just overwhelming.
Geographically, you mean?
Yeah. Goryeo had 8,600 kilometers in coastline to defend. The central government could not possibly patrol all of that effectively. Warships would just appear with alarming frequency, sometimes a few dozen, sometimes hundreds. Defense was basically impossible.
And the effect on the civilians must have been existential, leading to huge social dislocation.
It was catastrophic. The Woku followed a pattern. They'd plunder the vital granaries, steal iron, enslave locals, and burn entire villages to the ground. This constant threat forced people to just abandon huge stretches of the coast and flee inland.
So you see actual depopulation in the records.
Mass, prolonged depopulation. There's a village called Henghae in modern-day Pohang, which was historically a bustling, fertile area. But records from around 1380 describe it as completely empty. The roads were overgrown with thorns because everyone had either been killed, looted, or had just permanently fled.
So when a government is facing that kind of social collapse, how did its failure to mount a defense lead to deeper political problems?
The court's inability to respond was systemic. Their first attempts back in the 1350s failed spectacularly. They tried to get local elites, the Hangi, to provide troops, but these local magnates just ignored the king's authority. The central government had no real power outside the capital.
So what do they try next?
A heavy-handed approach. They tried forced conscription of local farmers, and crucially, without pay or enough provisions. And that triggered a massive peasant rebellion in 1351.
So the solution was worse than the problem?
In a way, yes. That rebellion showed just how impotent the king was. It directly led to the Yuan court stepping in and installing a new, reform-minded king, King Gongmin. So you see, the Woku crisis was fueling internal political collapse long before the dynasty actually ended.
And into this environment of military failure and political decay steps General Yuxiangai. He would eventually found the Joseon dynasty. He basically becomes the military solution the state itself couldn't provide.
Yuxiangai was one of the very few commanders who had the tactical skill and the regional loyalty to successfully fight both the Woku and the remaining Mongol remnants throughout the 1370s and 80s. His entire political career was built on his ability to solve the Woku problem, a problem the central court had basically given up on.
He made himself indispensable.
Completely. And the peak of this crisis, and really the definitive moment for Yi's rise to power, was the largest battle of the era in 1380.
Right. This is a massive operation.
It was huge. In May of 1380, the largest Japanese invasion force ever seen, the sources say 500 warboats landed at Jinpo.
And that location is strategic, right?
Very. It's right at the border of the critical grain-producing provinces, Chongxian and Jeolla. The sources suggest this wasn't random at all. The lord of northern Kyushu was struggling in Japan's civil war, and he desperately needed supplies from Goryeo's vulnerable granaries.
So this wasn't just a raid, it was an invasion.
This was the largest confrontation between Korean and Japanese military forces for over two centuries, until the Imjin War. And in August of that year, Yuxiangai was made commander of the forces in the south to deal with it. It was his first major independent command.
Which leads us straight to the Battle of Huangshan, where his military brilliance and maybe a flair for the dramatic really comes through. What were the actual tactical reasons for his victory there?
The Battle of Huangshan cemented his status. The core of his brilliance was tactical anticipation. He knew the Japanese forces were near Namwon fortified, but he guessed they'd try a mountain ambush.
So he used the terrain against them?
He did. He used superior tactics, splitting his army. He sent a large force down the main flat road as an obvious decoy. Meanwhile, he personally led a smaller elite force along a hidden twisting road up above. He correctly predicted the Japanese would use that hidden path to surprise his main army, but instead, he used it to surprise them high up in the hills.
He outthought them. But the battle itself, I imagine, was still decided by the skill of his soldiers.
It was. Yi's troops were famous archers, and their use of the yuyapchan, these small willow leaf-shaped arrows, helped turn the tide. But the legends around this battle are just as important for understanding his political rise.
Like the story about his aim.
The famous one, yeah. Repeated in many accounts. It claims that Yi himself promised his troops he would only aim for the left eye of his opponents. And when the battle was over, the story goes that 17 pirates were found with arrows in their left eye sockets.
Now, are anecdotes like that or the famous Pikpik story, are they verifiable? Or is this just brilliant political propaganda to legitimize his later coup?
It's very difficult to verify them empirically, but their power is in their political function. They were designed to show two things. Yi's almost supernatural precision, marking him as a destined leader, and his calculated fearlessness. They were excellent propaganda, vital for getting support.
Tell us that Pikpik story, because it illustrates a kind of psychological warfare better than anything.
Okay, so Yi chases the main Woku force to this makeshift fortress, barricaded with tangled brushwood. Instead of ordering a costly frontal assault, he does something completely unexpected. He orders his troops to halt, unsaddle their horses, and sets up a picnic table right in front of the pirate stronghold.
He's literally putting on a show for them.
A full performance. He ordered music, he ate and drank, he even sang loudly, all while the enemy is watching from behind their barrier in, you know, growing confusion and unease.
And then?
Then, and only then, did he have his men calmly set the brush barricade on fire. The strategy was to make them panic before the real fight even started. A desperate arrow even struck a wine bottle right in front of him, but the sources say he just ignored it, lifted his own bottle, and sang louder. He was signaling his total contempt for them. Terrified, the Japanese had to flee the smoke and chaos, and they were almost all cut down. It cemented his reputation as clever, fearless, and invincible.
So the Huangshan victory was the decisive moment. It ended the large-scale invasions of that era. How did that military success translate directly into the political capital he needed to overthrow a dynasty?
The transformation was total. He was no longer just a regional commander. He was a national hero, the general who saved the people. When he got back to the capital, Gaegyeong, he was greeted with enormous fanfare.
And he was very careful to cultivate this image, wasn't he?
Extremely careful. He cultivated this image of selfless dedication. When the king offered him 50 taels of gold, Yi dramatically refused, saying, "It is my duty as a general to kill the enemy. How do I dare accept it?" He even made his common soldiers return their heavy tent poles rather than taking lighter bamboo poles from local villages, arguing the bamboo belonged to the people.
A general of the people.
Exactly. This calculated modesty built his reputation, which was essential for winning public support against a decadent court.
And so, the military crisis created by the Woku provided the moral and political justification for the final act, the Wiwado Retreat.
It did. The Wiwado Retreat in 1388 was the final move that set the stage for the Joseon Dynasty. The king and the old guard ordered Yi to invade Ming territory. Yi strongly protested, presenting the four reasons why it was impossible.
Let's break those down, because they really summarize the geopolitical challenges Goryeo was facing.
Okay, the first reason was purely strategic. A small state like Goryeo could not possibly win against the much larger, more established Ming dynasty. The second and fourth were practical. Campaigning in summer was bad due to weather, and the monsoon season would bring diseases that would kill the army faster than any enemy.
And the third reason?
The third and the most politically powerful reason for the people and his soldiers was the continued danger of the Woku. He argued they would exploit the army's absence to pillage Goryeo villages.
So he strategically used the very threat he was famous for solving as the justification to turn back.
It was the perfect righteous justification to turn his army back from Wiwa Island. This act of insubordination was a coup. It led to him seizing control of the government, and in 1392, founding the Joseon Dynasty, a dynasty born directly out of the Woku Crisis.
So the Woku Crisis was a catalyst for dynastic change in Korea. But in China, the exact same threat led to a very different state response from the new Ming Dynasty. This response, the Heijin policy, is famous for having, well, devastating unintended consequences.
It did. The Ming enacted the Heijin, or Maritime Prohibition Policy. They tried to halt all non-governmental sea trade in contact with foreigners. The basic, very simplistic belief was that if you restrict maritime trade, the Woku problem will just go away.
And yet, the sources are pretty clear that this was a flawed premise. It actually made the problem worse.
They absolutely are. Organized piracy, especially the high-value kind we see in the 16th century, emerged almost entirely as a consequence of this trade ban, not the original cause.
Before we get to that later crisis, what were the immediate military effects of the early Woku raids on China, say, in northern regions like Shandong?
Shandong is a massive peninsula, and it was a huge commercial hub during the previous Yuan dynasty. We found Korean shipwrecks there that prove it. But Shandong suffered these recurrent Woku raids between 1370 and 1374, and it caused major depopulation and suffering.
So the Ming were forced to react.
They were. They were forced to shift Shandong from a commercial center into an exclusively defensive military base. The Woku threat prompted officials like Wu Zhen and Tang He to order the building of castles and fortifications all along the coast. And you can see this in the archaeology. Later shipwrecks found there are official warships built for coastal patrol, not the earlier civilian cargo ships.
A clear shift from commerce to military defense.
Okay, let's get to those disastrous consequences of the Heijin policy in the 16th century. It created this massive transformation in who the pirates actually were. This is the critical pivot point of our deep dive. By the mid-16th century, that official designation, Japanese pirates, was practically meaningless. Contemporary Chinese records, military reports, official memorials, they all indicate that only about 30% of the combatants were actually Japanese.
So who was the other 70%?
The vast majority, up to 70%, were ethnic Chinese. They were smugglers, displaced coastal merchants, and often the wealthy local gentry who were funding the whole operation. The Chinese were playing the leading strategic and financial roles.
So the prohibition essentially turned wealthy, established merchants into criminals overnight, driving them into the arms of smugglers.
That is precisely what happened. It forced them into incredibly lucrative contraband operations. They collaborated with foreign traders and pirates just to get around the bans. The government's attempt to centralize power failed because it completely ignored the deep economic and maritime traditions of its own coastal people.
And it led to internal rot, didn't it?
It did. The governor of Zhejiang, Zhuan, who was charged with stopping the Woko, he famously complained, saying, "Eliminating foreign banditry is easy, but eliminating Chinese banditry is difficult. And eliminating banditry in China's coastal waters is easier than eliminating banditry by Chinese civil servants."
So corruption from within.
The internal corruption and the complicity of the gentry undermined the whole policy. It guaranteed it could never succeed.
And this massive contraband network wasn't just local, it became global. And it was all fueled by China's insatiable demand for one thing.
Silver. The global economic connection is the key to the 16th century piracy boom. China had this huge surging economy and a massive demand for silver to use as currency, especially after tax reforms required payment in silver.
But domestic mining wasn't enough.
Not nearly enough. And the Ming government, fearing private wealth, actually restricted mining and trade. This imbalance made unofficial dealings with foreigners extremely profitable.
And the Woku were the critical link for this. How did a specific technological transfer help?
The breakthrough was the cupellation method for refining silver ore. This method uses lead to separate silver from other metals, and it's crucial for processing low-grade ores efficiently.
And how did it get to Japan?
It was transferred from Korea to Japan's Iwami Ginzan mine in 1533 via illegal trade routes managed by these Wajin and Chinese merchants.
What was the effect?
This technology vastly increased Japanese silver production. It transformed Japan almost overnight into one of the world's main sources of silver outside the Americas. This allowed Japan to export huge amounts of silver, which the Chinese economy desperately needed, in exchange for Chinese luxury goods like silk and porcelain.
And the Woku smugglers were the middlemen making a fortune.
Astronomical profits. It made the illegal trade network more economically important than the entire legitimate state economy.
This sounds like a global feedback loop. I mean, the sources confirm that the ultimate destination for global silver, whether from Japan or the Americas, was China.
Absolutely. When you look at the big picture, the massive amounts of silver Spain was pulling out of the Potosi mines in the Americas, it eventually all funneled into East Asia. The Woku smuggling networks became this indispensable part of the global trading system, forcing China to stay integrated despite its own embargo. The Heijin policy had created the perfect conditions for a massive criminal enterprise.
So, faced with a threat that their own policy was making worse, the Ming government had to deploy a military response. Let's look at the systemic weaknesses that made fighting the Woku, who were often their own armed merchants, so difficult.
The Ming military structure, the Waisu or Guard Battalion system, was initially robust. In theory, soldiers inherited their positions and were self-sufficient, growing their own food. But by the 16th century, that system was in severe decline. It was riddled with corruption and mismanagement.
I understand the profession of soldiering itself had become just completely degraded.
It was one of the lowest prestige jobs in the Ming dynasty. Soldiers were often illiterate, and military officers were treated with disdain by civil officials. This created terrible corruption. Officers would use their troops as unpaid construction gangs for personal projects instead of training them.
So the official numbers were meaningless?
Totally. The registers might list 3 million hereditary soldiers, but contemporary observers estimated the actual fighting strength was less than a third of that. And modern quantitative studies estimate that in some vulnerable coastal provinces, the actual army strength could drop to a mere 2% of its nominal capacity.
That is a massive gap between paper strength and reality. It must have created huge security holes.
It led to shocking, highly publicized failures. The most famous example is the Nanjing incident of 1555.
What happened there?
Ming records state that a mere 60 pirates arrived on a single ship near Nanjing. Now, Nanjing was a massive vital city, nominally garrisoned by 120,000 troops.
Wait, 120,000 troops were guarding the capital region, and only 60 pirates caused a major incident.
It was an absolute disaster. These 60 men found almost no effective resistance because those 120,000 troops, they weren't cohesive, trained, or loyal. The pirates rampaged for 3 months. They crossed over 1,000 miles of territory and killed 4,000 people before the government could finally organize a force to crush them.
That single anecdote just perfectly illustrates the institutional decay.
It does. The soldiers were there on paper, but the capacity, the loyalty, the command structure, it was all completely hollowed out by corruption.
So clearly, the traditional military structures were failing. What about the fixed coastal fortifications the Ming tried to implement? We have some fascinating modern quantitative analysis on how effective those were.
We do. The Bing military adopted this complex, multi-tiered approach, especially in high-value areas like Fujian province, and they divided Fujian into sectors northern, central, and southern based on geography and economics.
And modern GIS analysis breaks this down into a three-tier framework.
Right. First, you have independent defense capability. That's the strength of a single fort, its walls, its garrison. Second, joint combat capability, how well forts can coordinate and reinforce each other. And third, command and deployment capability, logistics, resources, political support.
So what did that data reveal? Where did the Ming government put its resources and why?
The analysis shows a rational, adaptive strategy. They scaled their defenses to economic value. The central coastal defense sector, which included the major economic hubs of Fuzhou and Quanzhou, the most frequently targeted areas, had the highest overall defensive effectiveness score.
So they're protecting their money.
They're protecting their core assets. Key strongholds there scored significantly higher than forts in the less vital southern or northern sectors. It validates the strategy.
That makes sense for resource allocation. But where did the system struggle? What turned out to be the most crucial element for a successful defense? Was it the height of the walls or coordination?
The statistical analysis was clear. Coordination joint combat capability was absolutely paramount. And the single biggest factor driving that was spatial accessibility.
Distance.
The military layout was incredibly sensitive to how far apart the citadels were. Any fort separated by more than the Ming infantry's daily marching limit, about 50 kilometers, they became weak links in the chain.
So a strong fort that was too isolated was still vulnerable.
Exactly. It could fend off a small raid, but if a larger fleet hit that area, it would likely fall because no reinforcements could get there in time. In the Fujian data, some forts were separated by over 190 kilometers from core strongholds, making them very tempting targets.
So if distance was the enemy, how did the Ming try to compensate for that limitation?
They used sophisticated infrastructure. They built naval fortresses, shuizai, right on the coast to house patrol ships. And crucially, they implemented this dense, rapid communication network using thousands of beacon stations, the Fangu.
How close were they?
On average, just 2.5 kilometers apart along the coast. It was a multi-tiered information network. The beacon stations were for immediate warning, using smoke or fire signals. These signals were then relayed to command centers and inland posts that had cavalry ready for rapid mobilization. It shows they understood the importance of intelligence and speed, even if their troop quality was poor.
But while the Ming are focusing on walls and beacons, the Woku, or the merchant pirates, are adapting technologically at sea.
The technological asymmetry grew very quickly after 1500. To protect their incredibly lucrative cargo of silk and silver, the merchant pirates armed themselves with the newest Portuguese guns and cannons.
And the Ming were slow to adopt them.
The Portuguese reached China in 1513, but the Ming deployed most of these new weapons on their northern frontier against the Mongols at the Great Wall. They largely ignored the coastal threat until it was too late.
And this brings us to the critical introduction of the arquebus in Japan, which was facilitated by this very pirate network.
Yes. The Woku network, specifically a prominent Chinese merchant named Wang Zi, helped Portuguese traders reach Tanegashima, Japan in 1543. And this interaction led directly to the introduction of the arquebus, the matchlock firearm, to the Japanese for the first time.
And they took to it quickly.
Very quickly. The Japanese fighters, already feared as swordsmen, mastered these firearms and rapidly began manufacturing them domestically. This gave them a significant modern technological advantage.
So the pirates actually had better weapons than the state military?
In many cases, yes. The sources say that Ming troops were reportedly terrified of the pirates' arquebuses. You had a situation where the pirates had better weapons, greater motivation money, and the element of surprise, all against a corrupt, poorly equipped Ming military.
It's clear that the Ming government's own policy, the Heijin, was the main fuel for this fire. If prohibition and militarization failed, what was the ultimate solution that finally brought the piracy levels down?
The ultimate solution required a fundamental reversal of the dynasty's founding policy. Piracy only dropped to negligible levels after the official abolition of the Heijin policy in 1567 CE under the Longqing Emperor.
So after decades of failure,
decades of disastrous failure, it was urged by forward-thinking officials who saw that the policy was the problem.
So a state finally admits that legitimate trade is the solution, not the problem. That seems like a huge ideological shift for the Ming state.
It was a pragmatically forced retreat. They essentially legalized maritime trade for Chinese citizens. The old smuggling port of Yuegang was officially renamed Haicheng, which means clear seas, and designated for authorized foreign trade. They set quotas and required merchants to pay duties.
Did they allow trade with Japan?
Officially, no. Trade with Japan remained forbidden because of the historical context. But Chinese merchants immediately began trading with everyone else, and often with the Japanese through third parties like the Portuguese in Macau or the Ryukyu Kingdom.
So by allowing legitimate commerce to flow, they starved the pirate networks of their financial base.
Exactly. The immense profits that had gone exclusively to smugglers were suddenly redirected into state coffers. It solved the problem almost overnight.
And the timing of this is crucial. The end of this Woku crisis marks China's formal entry into the modern global economy.
It does. The lifting of the ban in 1567 coincided almost perfectly with the arrival of the first Spanish galleons crossing the Pacific, carrying all that silver from Potosi. By opening its coast, China was formally integrated into the global trading network, a network that, ironically, the Woku smugglers had already spent a century illegally building.
So looking back, this Woku problem created two profoundly different historical narratives in East Asia, even though the threat came from the same place.
In Korea, the Woku crisis was the direct catalyst for dynastic change. The Goryeo dynasty failed to solve it, which created the military vacuum and political opportunity for General Yi Sangai to rise, prove his legitimacy at Hwangsan, and then use the ongoing pirate threat as justification for his coup.
So the Joseon dynasty was born as a state designed to manage this maritime threat.
Fundamentally, yes. It was designed to be a militarily competent successor state.
Meanwhile, in China, the crisis was less about foreign invasion and more about internal institutional failure.
In China, yes. The Woku crisis demonstrated the ultimate failure of centralized maritime prohibition. The Woku evolved from Japanese islanders into this extranational manifestation of global economic forces dominated by Chinese smugglers. The Ming's adaptive military response, like what we saw in Fujian, showed they could strategically defend their core assets, but only after immense internal suffering.
This whole story, from Yi Xiangai's calculated audacity to the complex identity of the Wujin, it's a textbook case of how external pressure exposes and reshapes internal political structures.
It forces us to ask deep questions about what a state prioritizes. If you look closely at that quantitative data from the Ming coastal defenses, you see the strongest, most resilient defensive systems were deployed precisely where the economic stakes were highest.
That strong central coastal defense sector, it wasn't just defending against bandits, it was defending the source of national wealth.
Exactly. Which leads to a final thought. If the Woku, whether they were impoverished Japanese islanders or wealthy Chinese smugglers, were primarily driven by their inability to engage in legitimate commerce because of the disastrous Heijin policy, was this century of coastal warfare truly a fight against foreign bandits?
Or was it something else?
Or was it, in practice, a massive violent negotiation between imperial authority and the unstoppable, overwhelming force of global economic necessity? The pirates were negotiating the terms of trade with cannon fire.
A negotiation conducted with arrows, arquebuses, and massive fleets of silver. Food for thought as you consider how much control a central government truly has over the flow of wealth once the global market decides otherwise.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.